So we wanted to talk about, I don't even know what's his name, Huberman, the
Huberman
Uberman.
has five girlfriends. Who gives a fuck?
Yes. Yeah,
But
well,
that's that subject over us.
everybody gives a fuck apparently at the moment.
Well, why?
No, it's like because he's like super successful and he's like a Stanford professor and he's five girlfriends that don't know from each other and he's like the super successful. And it's like, yeah, that's fine for me. But I mean, it's all within the frame of, achievement society
Is
and
he
that
gonna
you
lose his
only.
job?
Huh?
Or
What?
is he gonna lose his job?
No, why would he?
Well, I don't know.
No,
I
that
mean,
was
if
just
he's.
like the New York Times or article that, was more or less like a hit piece on
Yeah.
him. And but what I find very strange is that, and you wanted also to talk about anxiety because, like, as if achievement, like on a romantic or professional level, is a valid way to counter anxiety. And I mean, just to contextualize it, like the English aristocracy from the 19th, 20th century, even, they thought of achievement as something only, the lower classes will do. They would never engage in something that resembles anything of, oh, I did this with my day. So this free libertine kind of way of living without any achievements or without any direction, that was the ideal. And so the idea, and then with the 60s, the American achievement ideal like came into full fruition that we have to do this and you have to do this and you have to be fit and you have to have great sex and with a lot of girlfriends and you have to have like a college education, PhD and whatever. And then you're okay. But only then. And then you don't have to feel any existential anxiety anymore. And so this is like what I'm thinking about this. I mean, if you want to go down this path, that's great, but I don't think it's necessary.
I would think having five girlfriends would cause me a great deal of existential anxiety. I don't know about you, if you could handle that many women. I think one is really, a lot, but yeah, I don't know. Well, there was this guy, Robert Palacio, and we had a podcast with Alexander Bard and Robert Palacio last night. It will be published soon, and he has a book called The Age of Anxiety. And I asked him that, just to be, anxiety is a sort of more technical term, and well, he talked about the progression from it used to be called melancholia. And he had this other interesting word for over the ages, this it's being sad or being permanently sad or down was sort of considered like you've lost your soul or something, and you would go to hospital or you'd go see the shaman or whatever. But I think today it's quite extraordinary how fucking depressed everybody is, on a global level, and just strikes me that it's not just young girls committing suicide because of Instagram. It's a general malaise, which isn't even like it's not a malaise that is sort of necessarily the kind of malaise that you need to give a label to. It's just kind of life today is kind of like depressing. People have information anxiety or information stress, and they don't feel too bad, but they don't feel good either. Like, and what is the cause of that is an interesting thing. I mean.
I mean, nobody has the right to be happy. I
So
mean, it's
that.
like, because I saw it's interesting that you mention melancholy, because melancholy, how do you pronounce this? Melancholy? That was a heightened feeling still. It's like you feel the dread of existence itself, because existence is pretty dreadful if you think about it. Everything that emerges and will come to life will ultimately die. You lose your friends, you lose your family, and in the end of the catastrophe we call life, you know, stands your own death. And so it's like there's a pretty good reason to be melancholic about all of this, you know. But anxiety is something else, and I think anxiety is, you know, also like an integral part of existence, really.
I think that people aren't anxious about life and death. I think they're anxious about, you know, their Instagram picture. You know what I mean? It's not like they're feeling this existential dread that one day they're going to die. They're just feeling, what's the point?
Yeah.
And then there's just, you know, the hours and hours that people are, you know, hooked to screens and kind of like, you know, exposed to trivia, fragmented garbage, and you know, no wonder people are kind of like depressed.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because Instagram, because I mean that we are completely hooked to this, or people are hooked to the serotonin mechanism through social media. Mm-hmm. I was incidentally, you know, have you ever read Fernando Pessoa?
Mm-hmm.
And so I've read something about him, you know, the other day, which I found very interesting. And so he hated travel. He hated it so much. So he
traveling.
Was a pessimist.
Mm-hmm.
Traveling. So yeah, he was a pessimist. And he says, like, travel is for people that don't feel anything. And so I was like thinking, oh, really? So why is that? And I mean, so it's like you have, you know, this addiction to sensation and to, oh, that's the London Bridge. Oh, let's take a photo. You know, oh, that's the Eiffel Tower. Oh, let's make a photo. Let's go up there. But this is not real feeling. You know, oh, that's, you know, that's just, you know, this being hooked on sensory impressions for the moment, for the short-term thing. But it's not deep feeling. You
and
know,
there's
like
a profound disappointment attached to those kind of cliche experiences.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like you go and see the Eiffel Tower and you're like, so what, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it's like people treat, sorry to Andrew, but so people treat it as something that is like, you have to travel. It's like something individualistic. It's like, it's like a badge that you made it in life. But if everybody does it with these prices now, you can come, you can fly to whatever for under 500 euros. So that's nothing special anymore. And so it's like just capitalism and, you know, neoliberalism pushing, you know, certain identities onto you. It's like, why? It's like, it's what you say, it's completely void and empty of any deep meaning.
Yeah. I mean, there is something to, let's say, you know, Gurdjieff would call it, you know, getting sensations, you know, gathering sensations. Like, you know, when I was in Budapest recently, I was like, you know, it was like absorbing the feel of that place, you know, is a way of getting you out of your sort of the familiarity of your home place where everything has just become so familiar. So I think, you know, intermittent travel, it's like, it's not that it's that bad. It's just that when it's a way of sort of escaping emptiness, you know, your own self emptiness, your own feeling of void, your own feeling of anxiety, it doesn't tend to work.
Yeah.
Like you have the vacation and you come home and you're still who you were before. You haven't really gone on a voyage, you know, you have to go on an adventure. Like the human soul needs adventure, right?
Yeah.
And the other thing you were saying, Roberto, is it's the in marketing, they're trying to create this frictionless world, this world without friction, where everything is smooth and easy and you can just kind of go from hotel to airplanes in this sort of frictionless space, even dating and sexuality, and you can just find somebody and kind of like, and that the lack of friction is what's causing people the anxiety, because that creates such a huge shadow. You know, because we need friction even to have a, like he was saying, to have a conversation, right? Even now there's some friction between us because we're having a conversation.
Right.
And people want a frictionless world. And even in marketing, they're trying to, you know, create that.
Yeah. I mean, it's like what you said. It's like it doesn't really matter if you go to Bali or, Thailand or, Mexico and Tulum or Paris. It's like when you go on these places where everybody goes, that's not, that's pre-designed for you and to have an experience which is frictionless. But the truth of the matter is the only way to get true experience is if you venture outside of this. So it's like, if I remember, doing the hikes here in Mallorca, it's like I forgot all about it when I just used the path and the roadways that were designed. It's like the memories that I have are those when I left the place and just went straight into the mountain where there was no pathway, And so I, like, it's just a little metaphor for, it's like you don't get real experiences when you do what everybody does.
When you do the packaged thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, when everything is packaged and everything is convenient and everything is easy.
Yeah, that's what I mean. And Pessoa thought that melancholy and, that you need deep feeling to have a meaningful life, but you don't get that. And it's like if you just on the superficiality of things, if you're just at the surfaces, if you surf the surfaces, it's not a meaningful life.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
pain is kind of necessary, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I've been contemplating, Luke's, the title of his course on Gurdjieff, the hard way. It's like, why would you want the hard way when you have the easy way? And what's the easy way? Well, the easy way is sort of the hard way because you go through life kind of in a dream and then you end up with cancer and you're like, like that story of Tolstoy. I can't remember what it's called.
Right.
The death of Ivan Illich. And you're like, what was it all for? And then you die. So you have to kind of, I think in this era, you have to create sort of virtuous difficulty,
right?
Not like masochistic difficulty, but you have to create challenges for yourself. The other thing I was thinking about is that you have to, we live like in this time of where we have excess of everything, excess of information, excess of food, excess of experience, excess of, girlfriends, excess of we have just the unlimited excess of everything. So what you have to do is reduce things in your life, not add things to them, right? So the via negativity seems very important because everything is about time, right? Everything is about using your time in a way that is useful instead of being completely consumed by the products, the algorithms, the films, the TV shows, the podcasts, whatever. You can just be completely consumed by those things. So it feels to me really important. It's like the question is like not what to add to your life. It's like what to remove.
Yeah. I think it's like to periodically look into the abyss of things and the dread and the melancholy. And that's, it's like incidentally, that's what rubs me the wrong way with Huberman. It's like if I see a guy that does all the things correctly, he's a super achiever in every possible dimensions, like again, podcaster, biologist, whatever, romantically. But then I think, okay, so what does he, why does he do that so compulsively? What does he want, doesn't he want to see? There's something that is like restless, which is like kind of off-putting to me. It's like, so you have this, you propose this way of living in your podcast for like a myriad of young people and young men. Is that really the way to, to be, is that the way? Have
you mean
five
the obsession
girlfriends?
With health and wellness and that kind of thing? Is
yeah,
that
yeah,
what,
yeah, yeah. I
yeah.
don't think
yeah,
so.
There's something to that. But, I listened to a podcast with Rick Rubin about his life, Huberman. And he was a skater kid. He was kind of a homeless kid and a druggie. He was kind of came from a broken family. So I think he did look into the abyss, and then at one point got very ambitious and decided to so I felt sympathetic for him and, how he kind of climbed that mountain from out of the abyss. So I, you know, I don't know if he's that bad, you know. I mean, I don't
But it's
want
embedded, what I mean, it's embedded in this achiever culture. You
to.
know, you could say like it's in Wilbur's biodynamics terms, it's like orange, exit orange, greenish, you know, self-optimizing, still achieving. It's like, yeah, sure, but I mean, this is one frame and you can participate in that kind of world space if you want to. But again, it's like there are alternatives, and you know, it's like you can be you can be a libertine and achieve the same thing and probably enjoy more things than this kind of obsessive way of self-optimizing your way. Because I think self-optimizing is good to a certain degree, but if you do it excessively, then you're missing something. There's something,
That's
you know,
true.
that so and you know.
Well, I, you know, I'm very fond of Rick Rubin, as I said. I've been listening to his podcast, like the only podcast I listen to these days. And then, you know, he describes, you know, he had, you know, he was like 800 pounds at one point. He was like huge guy with heart problems. And he just lived at nighttime and did, you know, did music. And then he became healthy, right? In various ways. And one of the ways he became healthy was kind of like creating a home with no, let's say electricity almost. And, you know, so and like and you know, so that his body was adapted to bio, you know, biorhythms, and so that he had the right amount of sleep, and you know that his food was and he, so he's and then he spent a lot of time in the sun, and you know, did all these things, and now he's very healthy. But it's interesting, you know, when he describes and he talks to all these doctors, and you know, I've been listening to like Jack Cruz, and there's new studies about light and luminosity and red light and blue lights and its effect on the body and all this sort of stuff. And I thought it's like, it's extraordinary that the discoveries that they're coming up with in terms of how to optimize your health. But at the same time, you have to be a billionaire to live in a house without electricity. It's like to live a natural existence. That's so weird. It's like you have to become, you know, you have to be this. To have a natural existence, you have to be, you know, of the elite of the elite, and have all the that's extraordinary. And so his whole vision of life is to live kind of as naturally as possible. And it worked for him. You know, he lives near the sea, and he's got, you know, like ocean water and salt and lots of sun, and you know, just like living very, very, and not you know, and red light in his home in the evening, and all these things, right? It blows me away, but it's like, how you can't scale that thing. Like you, me and you are normal people, have to, you know, commit all kinds of crimes against nature to just exist, like send our children to school and you know what I'm saying?
That's
a bit
weird.
Of a rant, but you can only do these things if you're very, if you're like a Silicon Valley billionaire for the moment. I don't know, maybe everything will change, maybe they'll
But there's like this underlying mechanism which is so American. It's like to try to find, you know, a way to self-optimize everything to a degree where it's unhealthy, you know, like to have an environment where you can do those things and where you can, I mean, it's like I'm translating this book right now from Ken Wilber, The Religion of Tomorrow, right? And I don't know if you have read it, but it's his version of what Buddhism should be, right? And I mean, it's a misnomer, the title, because it's basically about his integral, you know, philosophy, which is not bad. But the thing is that, you know, you can't come from the outside and talk what Buddhism should be in your perfect worldview. It has to come out of Buddhism itself, and it may go in a completely different direction of what you might think it should be. But the underlying thinking is, oh no, how could you optimize Buddhism in a fourth turning? You know, how could you optimize, you know, your environment that you live in a certain way? And I think it's a weird ambition, you know, because it's always failing. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, like, because it's too systematic in its thinking. I mean, I guess Buddhism adapts how it adapts, right? it doesn't have to, it doesn't have to adapt to I guess the scientific worldview, because that's kind of like you want to adapt everything to the scientific worldview. You just have another canon of, like a Catholic Church, you have another canon of what is good and what is bad and what is acceptable and what isn't acceptable. And
Right.
so I feel like he's trying to create like a rational Buddhism or something like that. And I don't think, at least in the tantric traditions, it's supposed to be rational. It's supposed to be, I don't think it's supposed to be able to fit into
No, he
any
doesn't do. He doesn't want to do
any
it
scientific
rationally.
theory.
That's
Okay,
not. That's not
I got it
what. That's
wrong.
what. So he just wants to add, the layers of developmental stages and, states, like in a comprehensive kind of way, and make Buddhism richer in a kind of way. But it's still his integral philosophy. It's like, I mean, it's a good. I mean, theoretically, I think, Buddhism or every religion could benefit from it, but that's not the point, because you can't come from the outside and put this kind of layer.
Well, I
It
mean,
doesn't work like this.
to defend him, he did practice Zen and Vajrayana for many years, didn't he? He did work within Buddhism to a certain extent.
What I
But he
mean
also
is,
worked within Buddhism, and then he kind of says he's not
but what
really
I
a
mean is
Buddhist, so
like,
it's like,
there's like comprehensive data that education doesn't have the effect on children what we might expect that it have, and that you can have, a poor child with poor parents, and the chances that it will, develop a good intelligence and develop a better life is most like e equal to like wealthy parents. It's like you can't. That's the dirty secret of pedagogy, that that we hope to achieve something through education, but it's all up to the child how it develops and its internal mechanisms. And the same is true for Buddhism in a kind of way. So it's like we have all these great ideas what Buddhism could be, but it will do this on its own in a kind of way, or it won't. That's what I mean.
Sure. Yeah, what was I going to say? The other interesting thing we talked about in our discussion with Roberto about education is this idea of what education used to be, the purpose of it. And Roberto was saying redemption, right? Education is about re not in, even in a religious sense. So we all want to become redeemed, he was saying, we're depressed and we want to become redeemed. And education used to be a way of redemption, because it was more, I guess, tied to, let's say, religion. But we've lost that idea. So now education is about getting a degree and getting a position and getting a, and moving up the hierarchy, and or just getting a job that will make you safe and comfortable. And it's not no longer existential. It's no longer about redemption. So I think it's just about commodities. So in that sense, and then I said to him, I said, education is a crime, Today, like sending kids to school and what they're getting from it, when I send my kids to school, and I think it's a crime. I think it's a crime that we have to commit, because we live in, to be social beings in the society. Because I think it doesn't. I think it's not what it says it is, and I think it distorts human beings beyond recognition, or damages them.
Just too many people. That's my thinking. If you have a, if you have so many people, like we are, like 9 billion, and so obviously the everything dilutes in a kind of way. If you want to make it right for everybody, so you have to lower your standards immensely. This is so true
It
for
might be the
all.
case. I don't know if that's it, or if it's ideology, or if it's just a sort of a the fact that we're going through this technological paradigm change. in school kind of usually reflects the technology, and we're living in a real room mirror, as Marshall McLuhan said. Like, you still have classrooms with, with desks in rows, and that's 19th century, factory model of education. And we've already moved through, capitalism, and we're already in kind of late capitalism. And so now we have a sort of a corporate model of education mixed with a 19th century, mixed with a 19th century industrial model of education. And that the whole rest of, but then it becomes, it becomes anti-education, right? It just becomes crowd control. So I think that, I mean, not that there aren't good schools, but the anxiety issue, I think people are taught to, they're thrown into these spaces like of anxiety that are not
Yeah,
what
but
they
I
say they
think,
are.
for example, Huberman is a direct response to this and offers a solution, but instead of really offering a solution, it deepens kind of the problem. That's what I think about it, because it's like, that what he's talking about, these are not real, ways of really dealing with the tragedies of existence and to really find a remedy of, what we are, confronted with in existence.
So what are those then? I mean, I would say that
It
he's
doesn't
trying to get.
help your life if you go to the gym 5 times a week. It's just gay,
But yeah, I mean, it's not really what he's suggesting people do, but it is about becoming super healthy and optimizing your body and your mind to become just a machine, right?
Yeah, but in effect, that means go to the gym 5 times a week and then eat just broccoli and chicken and don't drink alcohol and, don't experiment with weird things. And, it's just like, it's just, I don't think it's, you have to be super focused on what you want. It's like, yeah, I get that, but that's not, I don't know, why would you do that?
Yeah, well, I don't know. Well, one,
What do
like,
you
I
want
would
to
say,
push out
I think.
if you design your day in a way that nothing that it's airtight and nothing weird can come in?
Well, that would never happen, would it? I mean, that can't happen in a day. It's just, there's too much entropy in the world. It can't happen. You can't have a day, a perfect day. They don't exist. There's no perfect day. There's no
Yeah, but
perfect
that's what I
body.
mean.
There's no
Design,
perfect mind. There's no
exactly,
total
but
clarity.
what.
There's no none of that.
Yeah, but
It's
that's
like
what
the
I mean,
human
Andrew.
realm
So
can't be
if
perfected.
you have your day and you design it, and then of course you can't maintain it, and so what happens? You create anxiety because you can't live up to the Instagram TikTok video of Huberman telling you how you have to conduct your life. And that's exactly what I mean. It's just like,
I agree. I agree. I think what we need is more joy, like more just like pleasure, like, but not stupid, titillating kind of like pseudo pleasures, right? We have so many pseudo pleasures. We so have so many half-assed pleasures, right? People are obsessed with food, and people are obsessed with TV shows, and even people go to, like, I was at the Shakespeare bookstore, which was this bookstore in Paris, and there's huge lineups to go in this bookstore because it's some kind of vintage cool place that James Joyce used to go to, and everything becomes a museum. But nothing is real anymore. It's like the whole world becomes a big museum, and that's kind of the problem. It's like it's that it's that's a kind of when you're at a low ebb of culture, that people don't have like ordinary joys and pleasures and like just ordinary joy of pleasure of like sitting outside my garden in the springtime, and it's like just these things people need just ordinary people need more pleasure in a good sense, not in the sense that not in the hedonistic short-term kind of like dopamine sense. I mean,
I'm repeating myself, but I think that, you know, you if you are able to look into the abyss of tragedy and are able to feel melancholy and all of these things, you know, and you are able to wrestle with the dark side of existence, then, you know, the blossoms of joy will pop up everywhere, you know,
yeah, that's
because
true.
But it's like as soon as you look for joy, then it becomes kind of, you know, you're looking for pleasure, but that's not what we're talking about, you know. It's like real joy, the real deep joy of existence. In a way, you can only feel that if you're willing to, you know, to let the dark side also in. And that's a kind of weird polarity. It's like, you know, you have to contend with, I think Cadell would say, lack and or non-duality, or, you know, that which is, you know, the weird part of existence, chaos, whatever, in order to
Well, I mean, I did think that means like being a body, you know, not just being a mind. There's something about, like, I think embodiment, because, you know, the body breaks down, it's vulnerable, you get old, you die. But people, I think, feel like in our age, we're aiming towards this sort of mass disembodiment. It's like a Gnostic dualism, whereas we're so yes, looking at the abyss and looking into the darkness and more than just knowing about that gives you energy, right?
We are a well of joy, Andrew, at the moment. We're like two whiny old men. It's so funny to me.
No, but I do things like, you know, every day to try to feel joy, like every day, like breathing, like moving, you know, things like this you have to do every day. So there's some of the, there's, you can take a bit of that from Huberman, which might be useful. Just like I agree with the essence of what you're saying. Absolutely. But I think breathing, you know, moving and, you know, just like, you know, having sex and whatever, just doing things that are, give you, you know, people need more of that. I don't think we need to go into this gloomy Camus existentialism again. I think that's like over. I like, fuck that. You know, Camus says, you know, I want to be a saint without God and all this sort of,
no.
You know, I don't think we need that kind of Sartre gloomy you know, just to push back a little bit about what you're saying, because I don't think that works either. So there's something else, right?
Yeah, but, you know, I think that's the interesting thing, to be able to. That's what I mean, not to get involved or not to get engulfed and swallowed by this thing, but to be able to. And that's
absolutely,
like that's my thing. You know, I was thinking about this in terms of, okay, what do we want to talk about today? Because I wanted to talk about this. I wanted to talk about Wilbur. And then there's like this other weird thing that ties in, that, you know, it's like, so you have like, for example, the metamodern movement and its weird infatuation at the moment with Christianity or whatnot. And it's weird to me because it's the same thing what Wilbur tries to do in a kind of way with Buddhism. And it's like, okay, so why, instead of being completely in your mind and trying to define how can metamodernism integrate Christianity, so why aren't you just in the and let it play out? It's like, okay, so we are now in this new phase. Now, what does it mean if you, with your body and with your emotions, with everything in this world, and trying to act in a way that might create something new? Why is it all in your mind? Why is it, you know, why do you need this overarching arc of you know, theory? And why do you want to push out the, you know, the things that might be chaotic and might be unresolved?
Well, that's the problem, that you're exactly right. You're trying to push something out, right?
Yeah. And so why can't you just, you know, like, delve into the gloominess for a moment and then delve in absolute joy and to find, you know, a metamodern aspect in being in the world and not just in your head? You know, what does it mean? But if you just have this Wilburian approach, I have my grand model of thing, and I package, you know, Buddhism in a new way, or I have like this meta-modern wrapping, and I try to think about, oh, how can we be, you know, integrate Christianity? That's, I don't think that's the way to go. I think there's something essential missing, namely that, you know, I think what meta-modernism or integral could offer is a new way of wrestling with uncertainty in a way, and to find new ways. But for that, you have to have the guts and the grit to be sometimes overwhelmed by, you know, the weirdness of existence, and not just have an explanation for everything.
Well, you know, I would say, like, okay, if you're going to flirt with Christianity and try to rationalize it into your model, or Buddhism, or whatever, you know, there's something about that that is like, you don't want to get your feet wet. You don't want to really take it on. You want to remain in an abstract intellectual realm, you know. It's like, go and become a Christian. If you're going to try to flirt with Christian, go and like do it fully, like be a Christian. If you're so into Christian, if you want to, don't try to make Christianity some sort of nice, neat package that suits your rationalistic modernist, you know, or your, right, you know, postmodern views. Don't go in, like, again, people were very critical of Jordan Hall, but at least he went and got baptized. At least he's diving into it. If he's going to be a Christian, he's not flirting with it, you know? So that's what I feel like. I feel like I don't want to be a Christian, you know, but I feel like, and the same thing with Buddhism is, you can't be like half pregnant, you know? You can't be half Buddhist or half Christian, or just a little bit of Buddhism here, a little bit of Christianity here, because some things make sense, but this doesn't make sense to me, and this doesn't make sense to me, and this makes sense to me. So I want to make sense. Like, you know, this is like making sense. I think that's the name of that podcast by the, you know,
Harris. Yes,
by Harris. He wants to make sense of Buddhism. It's like, I would say this is neurotic masculinity.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
And making, I think, you sense know, of everything. Fuck it.
And I think, I mean, it's like there's this dictum of, you know, you have to integrate. You have to integrate, let's say, Buddhism, or you have to integrate, you know, into the Christianity. But I mean, it's uncomfortable not to do it. And so we have this historical blindness that we're like, you know, as Zach Stein, in between worlds. We, you know, the old system don't really work. The new system haven't fully emerged yet. And it's uncomfortable to see, okay, we have a religious impulse or a spiritual impulse. We don't know what it might look like. It doesn't really make sense to reactivate, you know, old 2,000, 3,000-year-old systems. Maybe in the next 500,000 years, a new system will emerge. We're like in between, but it's uncomfortable. And to stay with the, you know, with that feeling of being uncomfortable, that we don't have, you know, a rational mind of making sense of Buddhism or Christianity. But, you know, in order to create a new religion, you have to go into the world and find a new way of wrestling.
I don't think you should create a new religion. I don't think anybody creates a new religion. I think it kind of emerges from.
I mean it culturally, you know.
Yeah, culturally. Well, you might, but I do think you need religious innovation all the time, you know. But you can't create a religion. But you need, because all the new religions are just ghastly, right? Anytime anybody has tried to create a religion in the last, I don't know, couple hundred years, you get Scientology, you get. Right. Cults, you get alien worship, you get all kinds of nonsense, right? So you can't create a religion. Don't even try, you know, but you can work within or without a religion, you know, on, you know, you can work, and then some, you know, and then you know, maybe a great being will come along and reform a religion. Or I think it's just, I don't think there's any creating of religion. I think it's something that just, it's like a body. It's like trying to create an AI or something. You can't create an AI.
That was not what I was talking. What I meant was, you know, we are in this phase where the old systems don't work, you know, and it's like the new systems didn't appear yet. And to, you know, obsessively trying to integrate Buddhism or to integrate Christianity, it's like, where is this need coming from to push this uncertainty, this religious uncertainty, is like to the margins, and like, why do you need to reactivate these systems? Why can't you just sit with a, you know, with a feeling of being uncomfortable, and to move with the world and in the world and be in the world and try to apply new principles in the world, you know, let's say new metamodern or integral principles, and then something might emerge or don't. But the point I'm trying to make is, you know, why this need to integrate, you know, compulsively, you know, Christianity? I don't see it. I don't know why you would do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and also, it's like, it's Christianity is so deep in everyone's subconscious anyway.
Exactly.
Because we're in that, you know, in the culture, you know, as is, you know, all the, you know, what are you trying to do? It's again, it's, I don't know. I was thinking about Gurdjieff's idea that really the consciousness is the unconscious. That's who we are, right?
Right.
We think we're the conscious mind, and we're on this like kind of like trip in the con, you know, but actually, yeah, who we really are is we're profoundly, you know, subconscious, or
right
in what we take on.
Yeah.
And you see people like, you know, who are, you know, very super intelligent people, you know, philosophers, and, you know, and you can tell that even though they don't belong to a Protestant denomination, they're actually Protestants.
Right.
And they're what they're doing is pushing Protestantism unconsciously, even though they don't believe themselves to be Protestant. You know, that's,
yeah.
I look at that, I see that a lot. I see a lot of, this is not even a critique of Protestantism. It's, you know, we could critique Protestantism, that'd be another issue. But aside from that, a lot of people are profoundly Protestant. In other words, they're not really willing to take on the baggage of religion, and they want some clean masculine religion that's removed from the original thing, which is more messy and more, more mystical and more weird. They want something cleaner. They want this clean machine, you know, like, yeah, that works. So that's, I, you know, maybe Huberman's just profoundly Protestant.
Yes, there you
and
go.
That's kind of what we're saying, and maybe we're all profoundly Protestant on some level, more than we want to be, right?
Yes.
Like we, so
that's the point. You can't get rid of, as you say, you know, of the contents of the collective unconscious. You can't.
Yeah.
It just gets transmitted from generation, and it's like it's already integrated. You know, we are already Protestant. We have all the Protestant work ethic and all that is attached to it. We just read Max Weber. He, you know, it's like we are that. It doesn't need to get more integrated. It is already.
Yeah.
We are already.
Yeah.
It is already our operating system.
Totally agree. Like,
and,
yeah,
and
maybe
so,
try to understand it first, not try to add something to it.
So, and that's what I mean. It's like integrating means, in that sense, you know, to become aware of it, see its limitations, but also see it's like we can't really escape the fact that it's, you know, our operating system, at least here in the West. But it doesn't mean that we have to, you know, pretend that it's like a new system that we have to integrate. It's already there, you know, and that's what I mean with being uncomfortable. It's like, yeah, at some point in history, in our collective cultural history, it provided some answers, and it still does, but these answers are very limited because we moved on.
On the other hand,
huh?
Just to add something to that, I agree with the point of remaining within the discomfort, but then at a certain point, should one take a stand and promote a certain values, you know, or not? You know, what stand are you going to take? What are you going to believe in? What are you going to, you know, what are you going to, what story are you going to buy, and what story are you going to promote? And do you need that? I mean, these are questions, not like, I don't have an answer, you know, but like you could be like Krishnamurti and say all religions are you know, manipulative and bullshit, and You can be enlightened outside of the, or you can go within a tradition and work very deep in that tradition and then transcend that tradition to a certain extent. There's a lot of possibilities.
Yeah, but my argument would be that you don't need an answer for these questions right now. Because, like, historically speaking, you know, if you agree that there is something coming after postmodernity, and it doesn't really matter how you call it, let's call it post-postmodernity. And it's like, historically speaking, that was just a blink of an eye. It just emerged right now. We don't need all the answers right now. We can just sit in the discomfort that it produces. And if we act in a certain manner, these answers will come automatically to these questions. But we don't, you know.
So if we lie in a bed of nails, after a while we'll start to feel the pain of the nails, and then we'll want to get up and.
I mean, if you want to use that metaphor, but I mean, like, more like, okay, you have a new principle, you have maybe like a flimsy idea of what integral or metamodernism or whatever you name it really means, and then you try to step by step apply it to the world, but just don't touch these big systems. Just like, try to be more conscious or more complex in your daily interactions with the world. You know, you don't have to reinvent the wheel right now. It just, like, feel what it means to supersede postmodernity and critique and theory, and, you know, just you know, I think, you know, it's like it's a kind of weird thing, because, you know, the pyramid, so the spiral, you know, from spiral dynamic, is always, like, you know, goes upside down. You know, the apex is at the bottom, and so it goes upward, as if the complexity goes bigger and bigger the higher the developmental stage, right? So that's the image, that it goes, like, from the apex to the base, you know? And so the more complex you are, you know, the bigger the pyramid. But I think in reality, it's like, it's more like a pyramid. So if you have really, like, an algorithm, you know, like a metamodern algorithm or integral, then it will spiral down to your behavior, like a pyramid. It gets bigger the closer you get to the base. You know what I mean? And so you just have to trust in that algorithm, in that higher principle, to manifest itself. And that takes time, and it's discomforting, and you know what I mean. It's like, you don't have to have a grand Christian theory. It's just like,
yeah, you don't have to have a theory. I mean, do you? I guess you do. I mean, I guess you need to. You just keep working on the metaphysics if you're a philosopher, and trying to get the conceptual. Trying to get the conceptual understanding as tight as possible. But I think there's a lot of youth in the metamodernist movement. There's a lot of, like, young people that are just taken by it. And there's always a revolutionary spirit in young people, right? And they just have to kind of wear that out. This is me being the old man, like, grumpy old man. But, you know, when you get a little older, you can see the overview a bit. You say, okay, you know, people are caught up in something, you know. They're caught up in a passion of some kind, and it's even. But it's not. It's not. They haven't. They. Well, I don't want to use the word integrate, because I'm kind of sick of the word integrate. But
yeah.
They haven't matured yet enough to. So a lot of what comes out is in utero. It's too early. It's too. A lot of philosophers make the mistake of writing their books too early, so they end up causing damage because their vision hasn't matured enough to be, you know. I think Wittgenstein and Heidegger and, you know, people have been accused of that as well. It's like, they wrote something way too early. They had a big, grand narrative way too early, and then they made a, then they look back and they say, "Whoa, did I ever make an outrageous leap in that particular place?" You know,
yeah, everybody wants to be Nietzsche, you know, like, be very young, be at the end of a cultural phase, and and be mature enough to formulate thoughts in a way that they are read still, you know, in 500 or 1,000 years, because they were at the precipice of something new, and it was reflected within him, you know. And so it's like it's still very important. And he was very young, but he was able to carry that for at least for a moment.
Well, he wasn't, you know? Was he?
No, but for a
moment.
I
am the crucified one with his arms around
the
horse.
That's why I said for a moment.
Because then he carried it.
Then he became insane because he couldn't carry the cultural weight of the cultural transformation anymore. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, there was an interesting discussion on one of the Telegram things about comparing Nietzsche to Aleister Crowley. And I was thinking about Nietzsche, and I think about these, think about, I still feel Nietzsche was tragic on some level. And, you know, and Crowley sort of, whether you like him or dislike him, he fully had a full life, or he went to the end, whereas Nietzsche, his life gets cut off halfway through.
Yeah.
So I feel like Nietzsche, again, falls into the Christian, he falls into the being the crucified one. Whereas there's something in Crowley that is very interesting in our artistic
we
way.
We talked about this. For me, it's
well,
the,
that, no, no. What I was thinking is that it matches the media age, because it's not philosophy. It's more like it's art, what he does, and religion. It's not just philosophy. It's not. He's in the new, he's in the McLuhan era, in a sense, Crowley, whereas Nietzsche is still in the death of God, the throes of the death of God, of the text era, you know.
I mean, he was a generation earlier, and I think mm-hmm. like in a previous episode we talked about, you know, the triangularic force of Aurobindo, Gurdjieff, and Crowley, because I still think that they, from different cultural context, represented the same new spiritual idea, you know. These three kind of things, you know, like you can call it integral yoga or whatever. It's like, you know, there's like, and they were like contemporaries, and Nietzsche was like a generation kind of before, so it makes kind of sense that he, you know, was the, you know, the grave, how do you call it, the grave digger of you know, an old paradigm, basically.
Yeah. Already That's what he was, yeah.
New, already seeing the new, but not yet able to. He was still a child of that time. He couldn't, and he died with that age, basically. Yep. You know, with that cultural paradigm.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah. And the other thing is that, yeah, again, he was a philosopher. And but he wasn't. Think about Aurobindo and Gurdjieff and these people, and they were also realized figures in the three brains, in the mind, the body,
right,
and not just in the mind brain, you know. So there was a multidimensional aspect to the thing that kind of transcended philosophy in some kind of a way.
Yeah. They had real life experiences.
They were capable of using philosophy, but they didn't get lost in mere philosophy, I would say, which might offend the philosophers here, but I still.
No, but they had all real life experiences, and you know, like very intense real life experiences. I mean, you know, you just have to read the biographies to see that they did things that, you know, the normal person in the Facebook firms would never even dare to dream of.
Yeah, and in a way, they embodied the Overman that Nietzsche fantasized about.
Right.
Right. They embodied that.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, and to close this out, I think, you know, that this Huberman ideal is a faint and distorted reflection of that. But it's not the real thing. It's like a distorted copy of that ideal that these three figures brought into culture. But this over-obsessive kind of self-optimizing thing, you know, I think that's a distorted reflection, you know, of that idea.
I wouldn't even put it in the same game. I wouldn't say it's a reflection of it. I'd say it's in another game. It's just, he's just a scientist. He's just a pop scientist.
But I mean, there is even the notion of that Huberman is the Übermensch, you know, like phonetically.
Okay.
So
okay,
phonetically,
well,
and so
that's silliness. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, it's like you have a guy who is like super successful in different areas of life, like, you know, it's a simulacra. It's like it's a distorted copy, but it's not the real thing. It's not, you know, the embodied, you know, real life. Where I mean. Either of these three, Crowley, Gurdjieff, and Arubov, they were wrestling with death. And
you
they
can't
were
compare
and they
those.
Were wrestling with, I mean, I hate to say it, but it's a new title of the book of Peterson. They were all wrestling with God in a kind of way that, you know, that it's completely void of what Huberman is. Huberman doesn't wrestle with God.
Actually, he's kind of become kind of religious. I don't know why you're comparing the two. Like, I don't. I think it's like comparing an ant to a lion. Like, why would he even? Why
because
would he? Why?
The,
why would?
It's
Why
a
would?
Mimetic.
Why would there even be a comparison? I mean, I don't have nothing against Huberman. Maybe he's a good scientist, but he's not he's not in that league.
Obviously not. But I'm talking
not
about
even
cultural.
Close to being in that league.
No,
He's not even in
obviously.
the
No, I
same
completely
world.
agree.
You know,
but it's you know. It's not this obviously it's not the same thing, but there's like how do you so there's, you know, if you look at these three and let's call them, you know, embodied people that wrestled with death and wrestled with God and tried to live what Nietzsche described as Übermensch, right?
Yeah.
Then you have, you know, somebody on the other end of the spectrum that kind of is in this kind of self-optimized style where you, you know, exceed in romantics, a romantic life and professional life and podcasting and fitness and whatever. And it's like, it's the same thing as if you would compare the Übermensch to a comic book figure of Superman. You can point that Superman, the comic, is a direct reflection of Nietzsche's Superman, but it's distorted. It's the same kind of thing, you know. There's like lots of literature about how Superman as an idea, as a comic, was conceived out of the Nietzschean ideal, and so but it is obviously not the same thing, but it's like a simulacra. It's like a contortion of sorts. And this self-optimizing kind of thing, it is in the same category of the comic book kind of thing.
Yeah, I guess self-optimizing is the problem with self-optimizing is like what Hahn would say, it's the problem of positivity, or without as you say, incorporating the shadow, without incorporating the darker aspect. But I mean, I never held Huberman to any high standard, so I can learn from him as just an ordinary scientist. I can't learn. I never thought he was a guru, you know. So I'm not offended by him in the way that you are. But I just think
I'm not offended. I'm just trying to understand the phenomenon.
I think he's, you know. Anyway, I wouldn't like. Why would you compare those things? You know, I think Uberman, you know, will have to live, you know, many,
because
many
they're
more lifetimes
mimetically
before.
Similar. That's why it is.
But that's what I don't get. You know, I don't get that.
You don't get the relationship between Nietzsche's Superman and the comic Superman? I mean, I'm not even
an
making
analogy.
This up. So there's a lot of literature how Superman was conceived. And so
but
there's
I don't
a
see the lineage from the Übermensch to Huberman. I don't see
okay,
that.
Okay, so but no, let's walk it through. So, but you know, there is a connection between the comic book Superman to Nietzsche's Superman.
Yeah,
you see that one.
I suppose.
Yeah, and so you have the idea of an individual that is excelling in everything that it does.
Yeah,
that's an ideal that we
yeah.
have. And that's what I mean. That's the mimetic underlying idea.
Okay,
that doesn't mean they're on the same level.
I follow. I don't want to get on any bandwagon against Superman because it seems like a bandwagon. I don't want to get on it.
Yeah, but we're doing a podcast, so.
Yeah, I mean, you're welcome to get on that bandwagon. I enjoy his conversations with Rick Rubin and, you know, on podcasts.
Actually, I don't enjoy my food. That's maybe the point. He's not on my wavelength. I find him pretentious and annoying.
Yeah, I don't. He's a bit. He's all right. You're just being a bitch, Tom.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm trying to I'm trying to stay at a higher level. You're trying to bring me down to your level of being a bitch.
Yeah, there we go. That's it. Now we found the truth of things.
I found the truth of things. We got to the abyss that you are.
Yeah, Tom. We got to the abyss.
Or the we are. Okay, that was fun as usual. Okay.